You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com. Or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Let's go out to eat and get some meat. Turkey and jam, macaroni and ham. Say, do you like steak? I can surely make.
You are listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Hollyman, and I'm back for another week of radio at the freshly adorned two-star New York Times Thumbs Up Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick. I am joined today by one of the young guns that's changing our food scene one bite or a word, if you will, at a time, food writer Nick Fischald. Thanks for coming on the show, Nick.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nick has built an impressive background of food titles, both print and digital. He's been a food editor at Rachel Ray Magazine and at Food & Wine, and most recently the editor-in-chief of TastingTable.com, to name a few. And so, you know, you've been covering the food scene for a pretty long time now. How did you become involved in food writing in the first place?
I guess I sort of fell into it by accident. I always loved to cook, and my first job out of college was at a magazine in the Twin Cities, and they needed someone to handle the restaurant coverage, and I was the first one to raise my hand. So I got thrown out there with the wolves and kind of learned as I was eating around and writing about it, and really took to it rather quickly, and a couple years later moved out to New York.
Well, so you grew up in Minnesota. Are you from like a food-obsessed family, or?
No, not so much. Probably a fairly average Midwestern family when it comes to what, you know, we cooked and ate. Minnesota's very Scandinavian, sort of heartland meat and potatoes cuisine. So that's what I knew.
So mom and dad, were they good cooks growing up, or?
My mom is a very good cook. I'm the youngest of six children, so she was a master at cooking for 8 to 18 people, depending on who showed up on a given night. I spent most of my childhood, you know, in the kitchen, either with her or at the counter watching her. And I think I picked up a lot about how to cook for a crowd that way.
I have to be honest, I've never been to Minnesota and I have no idea what's going on there.
Could you find it on a map?
That's also debatable. I wonder though, what's going on in the food world there? You know, what is great about Minnesota cuisine, and what are people doing up there that they're not doing here?
One thing that's interesting about it, I worked at a restaurant. I cooked in a restaurant there about 10 years ago for a little while, called Restaurant Alma, which was fine dining in terms of, you know, Twin Cities standards, and one of the better restaurants around there. The chef, a guy named Alex Roberts, used ingredients at that restaurant that were grown by his father and his brother on the family farm. And no one really thought much of that. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't their selling point. You know, they gave a shout out to the farmers and stuff that they featured on their menu, but it wasn't what people talked about when they talked about that restaurant. And now, you know, zoom ahead 10 years, and that if you don't have farms listed in your restaurant, people wonder what's wrong with you and where you're getting your food. So in many ways, there's still that humble mentality about many of the restaurants. But, you know, I still think it's one of the most underrated food cities that Minneapolis is, especially for, you know, having a huge variety of ethnic foods, Vietnamese and Mexican and Indian. I've had better Vietnamese food there than I'll ever find in New York.
Wow. And there's also like a cool art scene there as well too, right? And art and music.
Yeah, great art scene, great music scene. Yeah.
So I'm going to move from New York.
Terrible,
right now,
long, hellish winters.
Okay, never mind. I take that back. I never want to go there. So one of the things that's really interesting about you is that you were you were a food editor at Food & Wine for 2 years, and you took the leap from print to digital and moved over to Tasting Table during the time when there really wasn't anything else quite like it. And so seeing as you were one of the first people to sort of ride the digital wave, if you will, how did you decide to take this sort of avant-garde leap?
I don't think it was that avant-garde or smart or anything. At the time, I think I left mid-2008, there was sort of these storm clouds gathering on the horizon for magazine publishing, but I wasn't looking for a way out of print. I still believe very strongly in print magazines, especially print food magazines. I think they're going to be around for a long time. It's one of those topics that you want to engage with, you know, something on paper. You want to be holding the photos and the recipes that you're working with. So it wasn't so much I need to find a parachute out of print. It was more the chance to start something new, a publication without any idea what it should be. And that was really interesting to me.
So, you know, looking down the tunnel of food media, things are definitely dramatically different now versus a couple of years ago. And how do you think things have shifted over the last few years? And where do you think food media is going in the future?
Well, I'd say the big shift is who tells us what to eat and where to eat and what to drink. We listen to so many more people these days. A good example is right behind us. Sam Sifton wrote one of the most positive reviews of a Brooklyn restaurant, or, you know, pretty much any restaurant this year, yesterday. And I think in the past, and I've heard this from restaurant owners and chefs, you know, if that kind of review comes out, there's going to be a line at your door almost immediately. I mean, Roberta's is already packed all the time, but I don't think you're going to see too big a shift in how many, or too big a difference how many people are showing up every night. I don't think there are going to be busloads of people coming over from Manhattan who didn't come before. I think it will bring in new customers, but from what I've heard, you know, over the last few years, one single critic or, you know, one single article doesn't move the needle as much as it used to for restaurants. Part of that reason is because we're getting all our recommendations from friends, from complete strangers via, you know, all sorts of social media. And then there are just so many sources of semi or professional information out there, blogs and websites and magazines and emails and all that stuff. So there's so many voices now, probably too many, but it lets us figure out who we want to listen to. And I think we have so much more to choose from now because of that.
So that being said, who are some of those digital voices, if you will, whether it's Twitter or blogs or videos that you go to for yourself to find out like some really awesome information about what's going on?
Oh, man. Honestly, I still trust the more old school sources, the newspapers, magazines. A lot of these are print. Print publications. So I really still think I'm a little more old school than most people. I don't tweet, hey, where should I eat dinner tonight, and wait to see what my friends or people I don't even know send back. A lot of people do, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a matter of, you know, who do you trust?
Sort of like the Yelp phenomenon of the difference between a huge open forum versus a
yep.
congregating,
and,
yeah.
And what I've been seeing in you know, new types of social media, new platforms, all this stuff, it seems to be that the chorus or the community that you're pulling all of these recommendations from, all of this new technology is shrinking that community and curating it. Curating is like, you know, the word everyone's throwing out now. Instead of looking through, you know, a couple hundred reviews on Yelp from people you don't know, you're setting up your own small network. Google Plus is a good example of this, of how to create very specific small networks that will give you the information you want from people that you trust.
So now that, you know, it's 10 times more accessible to read or see these places that people sometimes idolize, whether it's like Momofuku or let's say Roberta's, you know, on the internet, people can watch videos or whatever in Thailand even and find out about it. I mean, I remember a friend was going to Thailand and had to just Googled blogs and had this full list of like, oh, I'm going to go here and eat this and eat that. It's kind of insane, you know, to think about where we are now. How, you know, do you think because there's a smaller curation of people that are providing the in the know facts, even though the audience is wider than ever, like how does that sort out? Like, does it just become a soapbox or do you think there's still opportunities for
what we saw at Tasting Table was, if you actually go and experience something and report on it or whatever, vet it yourself, that sets you apart from the vast majority of, you know, so much of the conversation about restaurants and food and whatnot is people repeating what someone else said. Like you said, you can go and basically have somewhat of a experience or a virtual experience of a restaurant and have never been. And you see people on Yelp reviewing restaurants that they've never even visited based on something they heard. So because of that, us being more of a signal than an element of the noise, I think helps our readers realize that they could trust our recommendations as something that was well vetted and, you know, carefully thought through.
What do you think today makes a good food writer?
It's the absence of the language that is so commonly used to talk about food and restaurants and whatever. When I have new writers, I usually give them a list of words not to use, and that list grows every day or every, you know, week. We'll find some new word that is kind of annoying and we'll add it to the list. And by omitting those words, it forces you to talk about food in a new way. And so I think that's what, you know, sets really good food writers apart from average food writers, is that they force themselves to describe something in a way it hasn't been described before. You can say something is yummy or delicious or whatever. Those words have lost their meaning, I think, over time and overuse.
Totally. What's the word right now that you absolutely detest when describing food?
The latest one, I would say delectable.
Yeah, that's like a delicious dish type of word I would expect.
I think that was in Sifton's review.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we've got more from food writer Nick Fischald. You're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you. less we say about it, the better. Make it up as we go along. Feet on the ground, head in the sky. It's okay, I know nothing's wrong. Nothing. Oh, I got plenty of time. Oh, you got light in your eyes.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by Nick Fischald, food writer and definitely one of the best cooks I know. And he chose that amazing song by the Talking Heads, This Must Be the Place. Although I always call it like home, I guess, because the chorus, I don't know. It's really good.
Naive Melody.
Yeah. Is that the official name?
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay. So see there, I totally messed it up. When you were cooking in kitchens, what music were you guys listening to?
None? Absolutely
wow.
None. The restaurant I just mentioned, Restaurant Alma, was dead silent.
Wow.
Very quiet.
Yeah.
Another restaurant I cooked in, I guess, had music. It was this giant Moroccan French restaurant with live flamenco dancers, and it must have been some kind of flamenco music. But when I cook now, it's a lot of kind of stoner music, a lot of Grateful Dead and Fish, actually, to be honest with you, and jam bands. It's like nothing puts me in the right state of mind for cooking like, you know, some old Allman Brothers.
Yeah, no, totally. I thought you were going to say AC/DC because I feel like that's the standard, you know, every kitchen that I've, you know, seen, they're always rocking out to that, but I'd love to.
But you can't relax while cooking AC/DC. That's why you need it in a restaurant kitchen. Yeah. You got to stay awake.
Keep the energy alive.
Yep.
I know, I'm still waiting for the day when I hear sort of Sarah McLachlan in a kitchen. Like Lilith Fair in Sambar. I would love that so much. The food would taste like so emotional.
Keep waiting.
Yeah, it might happen. David Chang, listen carefully. So before the break, we were talking about food media and all sorts of things, you know, about that are happening within food media since digital versus print is going on. So, you know, with the rise of all this digital stuff, whether it's a online publication or cookbooks or whatever, you know, what do you think right now print is doing that digital isn't, and vice versa?
Print magazines still have an advantage. It's much easier, I think, to cook straight from a magazine. You can bring it into the kitchen and hold it and not worry about getting it dirty and you can tear out pages and pin them to the refrigerator and things. There's still this tactile advantage to magazines, especially when it comes to food. And I think another huge advantage is the photography. I think the food magazines that survive and thrive in the long term are going to be the ones that embrace what magazines do best and stop trying to become printed websites with, you know, little chunks of information and tips and lists and all these things. The web is always going to do that better now, and the web is going to be more timely. So, you know, if I were going to start a print magazine from scratch, it would have great articles and would be a fun leisure activity to get through that magazine. It would have lots and lots of recipes and lots of photos.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, I feel like sometimes the issue I run into with digital sometimes is that I feel like I have ADHD versus a tactile print piece that kind of just, there's nothing popping out at me, a video or an ad that sometimes is better. And then sometimes it just depends, you know.
But I find the more that I'm consuming information online on websites, whether it's about food or anything else, when I return to something printed, I now slow down and read more slowly and more carefully and more, you know, keyed in than I used to. I used to flip through magazines very quickly because that was, you know, I wasn't doing that online. Now there's that yin and yang, I think, that, and, you know, print is now, to me, feels like a time to slow down.
Totally. So through all of your efforts in covering trends or seeing trends across the years in the American food scene, what are some current trends that maybe you find interesting or you think could reflect what's happening within our culture today? That sort of hint towards a feeling of that the American public's in need of or whatever, you know, does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I guess in a way it feels like we lost, or the North, we lost the Civil War. There's so much Southern food up here, which I love. My mom's from the South and cooks a lot of great Southern food. That's been the biggest movement is, you know, how Southern American food is kind of invaded all everything north of the Mason-Dixon, which is great. I don't know what that says about our culture.
We like
I don't
fries.
Know if Southern culture is, you know, invading the North the way Southern food is, but that, and I think we've, you know, spent the last few years not looking for as many far away foreign cuisines and adapting them. We've really been kind of looking through the corners of America and trying to find more regional foods. You know, every kind of quirky regional food in America now has been emulated and elevated and whatever somewhere else, which is kind of interesting.
Do you think that it has anything to do vaguely with our economics or after, you know, the so-called recession, mm-hmm. or does that have anything to do with these sort of guilty pleasures?
So-called recession.
Yeah.
You sound like a Republican.
Like, I don't know how to phrase it without offending everyone.
Probably.
Yeah.
It probably does. I don't know. You know, it's obvious that we don't spend as much on food when we don't have as much money to spend. So I think that does drive it. I think we're also getting a little bit tired of calling it comfort food. You don't see that word thrown around as much, even though that type of food, what we would associate with comfort food, is still a very powerful force and very, you know, very popular thing.
Or maybe we should retitle it boyfriend breakup food, because everyone's constantly eating their emotions right now.
Are you speaking from?
No, I just feel like it's. No, I'm totally fine. All right. What do you think some chefs are gravitating towards right now that are interesting? Like maybe it's a garnish or a weird technique, like burning everything, or I don't know, yelling at their customers. Is there anything that you've noticed that's a pattern lately?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
Nothing that jumps out. You know, trends are that they come up and they disappear. The cycle is so much more quicker these days that it's tough to say there's, you know, one technique that everyone's copying. There's no next sous vide as far as I've seen.
Who are some chefs right now that you think are pretty rad?
Man,
I'm asking you really tough questions. Or no, let's rephrase that. What's the last restaurant you went to Roberta's? What's the last restaurant you went to that definitely, or maybe it was like a corner store or something that you had an amazing thing that you ate?
A lot, partially because I live around the corner, but a lot of the happiest and kind of most invigorating, exciting meals I've had this year have been at Brucey on Court Street in Cobble Hill. Their food is pretty straightforward, but you know, just clever enough to keep you coming back. And the food is, the ingredients are very fresh. It's inspired, but it's not overwrought.
So, all right, we were talking before about cookbooks and digital, and I want to know, with new things that are out there that have been converted to, like, you can buy cookbooks on the iPad. What mm-hmm. happens when you stick that iPad in the actual kitchen and you get to cooking? How does that work?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this lately. Part of the problem with what we have right now, in terms of digital cookbooks or cooking apps or whatever you want to call them. They're not very user friendly when it comes to cooking from them. It's easy to read a novel on a phone or on a tablet or something. But if you've ever tried to cook from one of these, it's tough. And there's really nothing more to it than what you would get out of the book. Actually, there's less. They usually take the photos out, so it's not even as pretty. And you have to scroll through 10 pages to get through one recipe. So I've been, you know, thinking a lot about where that is going to head and what the cook needs out of a book that would be completely digital. And, you know, I think the answer is have it really adapt to the user based on what they're going to be using that book for at a given moment. Sometimes you sit on a couch and read a cookbook for fun. You lay in bed at night and flip through it. Sometimes you are trying to teach yourself a new technique or learn a new recipe from a cookbook. And then other times you just need the recipe that, you know, you've cooked 20 times, but you can't quite remember it. So you want it there in front of you for reference. So I think the publishers and the folks who do a good job with and shape the way digital cookbooks are gonna become will do that. We'll think about the experience in that way.
What are some new cookbooks that you're reading now and why?
I just got a copy of the Joe Beef cookbook, the restaurant in Montreal. It's amazing. Hilarious, really fun to read. You know, very lots of personality. It's a lot like the Au Pied du Cochon cookbook, very similar in many ways. And their food is similar in many ways. But, you know, the cookbooks that I think are really interesting these days are the ones that aren't just, you know, 100 recipes with colorful photos and anecdotes about the chef's, you know, childhood growing up in Calabria or whatever. They're the ones that really take you into the nitty-gritty, crazy gonzo behind-the-scenes stories at restaurants and really get you into that chef's personality. You know, the Momofuku cookbook's a good example of that. And the one that just came out, Mission Street Food, that was published by McSweeney's, is an amazing example of, like, multimedia. There's illustrations and comics and you name it. It's just an amazing piece of design work as well as a really fun read.
Yeah, McSweeney's is taking over the cookbook world by storm with the advent of Lucky Peach. Do you think that we're, you know, in 20 years, where do you think the food scene might go and how would you see it taking shape?
We'll just be eating little diet pills.
We'll be eating Soylent Green, probably. Exactly. Yeah, that sounds great. All right. Well, that's about it for today's show. Is there anything else for our listeners out there that they need to go read or eat or see before we get out of here?
I would pick up a copy of Joe Beef.
Do it. Well, there you have it, people. That was Nick Fischald, one of the most talented food writers I know. Nick, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much.
Thanks to everyone at Heritage Radio Network and Roberta's. And tune in next week for another episode of You Look Hungry. I'm Helen Holliman. See you later.
Get some meat, turkey and jam, macaroni and ham. Say, do you like steak? I can surely make. If you hear me now, sing it loud for me, crowd.
Following is a message from NOFA-NY. Do you dig local food? Love organic farmers? Do you crave to be part of a growing movement of consumers concerned with the state of our nation's food system? Then sign up today to take the NOFA-NY's Locavore Challenge this September. Join 5,000 other New York locavores that are hungry, active, and ready to change our food system. Learn more at www.nylocavorechallenge.com. This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.